offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I welcome all of you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the pleasure of coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me again on this journey through the Bhagavad Gita, this pilgrimage that we do together, where we learn lessons for life, and we do that with the prayer that Swami enables us to make these lessons the guiding light of our life, right? That's the most important thing. What is the use of knowledge that doesn't change the way we look at life, doesn't change the way we approach life? We are going through the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the Raja Vidya Guhya Yoga. We went through 3 verses last time, so as we always do, we'll start with a short summary of what we covered the last time. And just as I was saying, the whole idea of going through any spiritual text, trying to absorb any spiritual wisdom, is so that it changes one's life. And that is precisely what Krishna says in the 3rd verse of that chapter, where he says, those who do not take this advice that I'm giving, right? I am not going to be upset with him. Of course, he did not say it in as many words, but we had discussed about what it means when Krishna says, or when Krishna intimidates us by saying that if you do not follow this, this is what will happen. In the 3rd verse, he had said, those who do not have faith in this path that is being showed, ashraddhadhanaha purushaha, those men who do not have shraddha. As we saw, shraddha is a very interesting word. It's not merely having faith, but faith that leads to commitment, right? That's what's most important. Knowledge that creates faith, or rather faith that makes us turn towards that knowledge and make that knowledge a part of our philosophy of life, right? That's what we had discussed extensively last week. So one who does not have faith in this path that is being discussed and described here, he or she will be led to samsara, mrityu samsara vartmani. That path which will take you to this cycle of samsara, you will be led to that. This is not that Krishna is saying, I will push you down to samsara, but I'm showing you the path which will take you away from it. If you do not take to that path, you're going to go into that path which is going to have you bound in this cycle of death and life. The other point that Swami made, which was very interesting, was Swami had said that the sadhaka must uproot asuya. As we saw in the earlier verse, in the 1st verse, I think, of this chapter, Krishna says that I'm going to give you this yoga because, Arjuna, I find you as one who has got rid of asuya. I see you as one who has the quality of anasuya. So Swami says that asuya, the jealousy, has to be uprooted, and shraddha, this faith and commitment, must be implanted in that place. The next 2 shlokas, 4 and 5, speak of the contradictions that one comes across when trying to understand this relationship between God and creation. We will continue that discussion even today, but giving you a summary of what Krishna said there. Firstly, Krishna says that he pervades the whole creation in his avyakta form. The word he used is avyakta murtina, as the embodiment of formlessness. Literally, that's what avyakta murtina means. He says, I pervade this entire universe. That's the first statement he says. Then he says, matsthani sarvabhutani. I do not exist in them. They exist in me. All beings exist in me or abide in me, he said. And immediately he said, matsthani sarvabhutani nacha aham teshu sarvastitaha. They dwell in me, I do not dwell in them. And the very next shloka he says, nacha matsthani bhutani, and nor do all beings exist in me. When we then discuss this contradiction, we understand that neither is God contained, nor is God the container. The relationship between God and creation is far more complex, and the path to get there is probably to worship Him as being in a specific name and form. and then recognizing him as being contained in every name and form, and then recognizing the fact that he is not the contained, he is the container, and then going beyond even that idea and saying that he is neither the contained nor the container, he only is, right? As I said, that's again something that we will continue to discuss even today, the relationship between the creator and his creation. But before that, as I said, we will dwell a little more on that fifth verse. The last line of that verse, Krishna says, Mamatma, myself, Bhuta Bhavanaha is the creator of all beings, Bhuta Brit is the supporter or sustainer of all beings, Nacha, and not Bhutastaha, a dweller in the beings. An extension of that same contradiction, that I should say apparent contradiction, because there is no contradiction in what Krishna says. The contradiction arises in our mind because the mind is not prepared to see the truth as it is, right? So whenever I say there is a contradiction in the message, please don't pounce on me. We see the contradiction because our mind is still not clarified. There is no contradiction in the message as such. A very rare statement where Krishna says, I am not the indweller, right? And as we saw, this is to remove the ideas that come with the thought that God is contained in the individual. So this statement that Krishna is making here, na bhutastaha, conveys a wrong idea without the rest of the statements made in this portion of the Gita. In the path of devotion, and thereby so in the path of Karma Yoga too, to see God as the indweller of all beings is a very crucial bhava or feeling that one has to develop. But the jnana is to understand that the absolute nature of the Lord is something that negates all of these ideas, negates this idea that I am separate from the Lord. Right? The moment you say that he is contained, you're talking about him being a separate entity. So this statement does not mean that God is not in all beings, right? But there is a certain misunderstanding that tags along when you say that God is an indweller, and Krishna is dismissing that. After last week's episode, one of the listeners wrote to us and asked me if I can explain this with another example. In fact, they said a better example. So the example that I gave was not clear enough. And as I said last week too, it was not my example. I read it somewhere and I could relate to it. And that's why I thought I'll share it with you. The example of the jewelry and gold, right? This is what I had said, in case this is of any help. This is the explanation I gave that listener. And I thought I will share it here too. Imagine sugar in a container, right? Sugar cubes or sugar as powder. Imagine sugar in a container. The moment I tell you this, sugar in a container, you think of probably a glass bottle in which there is sugar, or a ceramic bottle or a plastic bottle, and you imagine sugar being in it in as cubes or as powder. Imagine instead a container made of sugar, containing sugar. The container itself is made of sugar, and you are preserving sugar in that sugar container. I hope you're able to get what I'm saying. Don't imagine a container that is made of glass or any other material. Imagine a container that is made of sugar, and I have filled sugar in that container. Then the bottle itself becomes only a modification of sugar, isn't it? Or again, the classic example, the clay pot in which I store clay. I can break that pot, and instead of a pot, I can make a clay spoon out of it, or a clay plate out of it. So that object was only a brief name form presence of the same clay that it contains. And clay never itself changed. Because it is a pot, is clay any different from the clay that is in a plate or in a spoon? So if you look at clay, its involvement in the utility of that pot is zero. We have made a pot out of it, and there is a certain utility we have given it, certain name and a usage that we put it through. But that doesn't change the nature of clay at all. Let us say I make a sharp spear of the clay. Does it make the clay cruel? If I make a toy out of that clay, does it make the clay playful? If I make a begging bowl out of the same clay, does it make the clay a beggar? So the clay has no involvement in the nature of the name and form modification it undergoes, isn't it? What Krishna is establishing here is the non-involvement of the Atma in the variety that is seen in creation. A point that we'll be seeing today too. Krishna is going to stress it in the shlokas to come. Mamatma bhuta bhavanaha. All beings are created by myself. Mamatma bhuta bhrita. All that is seen is sustained by me. I have a pot in front of me. By some technique, if I can suck out all the clay, will the pot still be there? The whole world as it is sustained by him being present in it. If I remove him, the world does not exist as it is. He creates, he sustains, yet nacha bhutastaha. He is not the dweller in the beings. If I remove God from this creation, the creation does not exist. But if I remove the creation, God is not affected by it at all. There is a clay pot in front of me. I remove the clay, the pot does not exist. But I remove this idea that this is a pot by maybe breaking it or grinding it. But the clay continues to exist. And that is the relationship between the creator and the creation. And Krishna is going to explain this with another example in the next shloka. As I said, no example, no analogy is comprehensive. Even if that analogy is given by Krishna, it is not comprehensive, right? That is the whole point that Krishna is trying to make in these shlokas by pointing out the contradictions that lie in every analogy that is used. Yet, he's going to give another analogy. We'll look at that. But before we go into that, one last word that many commentators explain, and I thought I'll throw that in too. The usage of the word mamatma. Mama atma. When I say my body, it means I am separate from my body. Body is something that I possess. Swami would often demonstrate this in his discourses. When he's giving a discourse, Swami would pick up his handkerchief and he would say that this is my kerchief. And dramatically, Swami would drop it and he would say, I am separate from my kerchief. Similarly, when I say my body, it means I am separate from my body. That being the case, it makes no sense to say my Atma, because there is no other me to possess this Atma. I am the Atma, right? That's the whole idea of this spiritual discourse, to establish my identity with the Atma, to dissociate myself from the body-mind complex and make me aware that my real identity is the Atma. And when I say my Atma, it makes no sense. And when I say this Atma is divine, it makes even more no sense for Krishna, who is the divinity, who is that divine, to say my Atma, mama Atma. Why is Krishna saying, my Atma is the creator of all things? Again, if I were to explain based on the theme we have been discussing through this portion, in worship, in upasana, in devotion, we superimpose a name and form on the Lord, right? In our case, we get confused with the name and form we are born with. In the case of the Lord, his swarupa, his true form, was always para prakriti, absolute, formless, akshara, brahma, right? In the path of upasana, we attribute forms and gunas to the Lord. We superimpose them on the Lord. We are born with a body and name and we're given a name and all of that. But in the case of the Lord, we superimpose name and form on him. And when Krishna says Mamatma, it is to distinguish the true self from the qualities that we attribute to the Lord. He is not in everything as Vasudeva Krishna or as Satya Sai Baba. He is existent in everything in his true Swarupa, which is Avyaktamurtina, as the unmanifest formless form. Right? So that is what it means where Krishna says Mamatma. There is, it does not mean that the Lord is somebody who possesses the Atma. He is that Atma itself. But this is to message in such a way that we are able to understand, right? So that's a point that is often discussed in this shloka. Many commentators, including Adi Shankara, makes a point of that. So I thought we will discuss that too. So we'll go to the next shloka, the sixth shloka of the ninth chapter, and we will see what Krishna says there.
Yathakashasthito nityam vayus sarvatra gomahan tatha sarvani bhutani matsthani tyupadharaya.
As the powerful element of air moving everywhere ever remains in the ether or space, know that so too all beings abide in me. So that is the sixth verse, and as I said, in this shloka, Krishna makes an attempt to explain this with another analogy. But as we will see, this is also limited and cannot convey the idea completely. But that is the nature of this concept, not the flaw of the one who is trying to explain, or that is the inherent flaw in our minds, inherent flaw in language, inherent flaw in worldly knowledge. But it is a good example nonetheless, right? I'm saying as though I have the authority to comment on an example that Lord Krishna gives, but from the point of view of it conveying an idea that makes sense to us, I'm saying that it is a good example, right? I'm not trying to certify the Bhagavad Gita in any manner. That's not the role I'm trying to play, or I have the authority to play either. Krishna says, yatha, just as Mahan Vayuhu, the immense and great air, Sarvatragaha, moves everywhere. Sarvatraga means omnipresent, but when used as a verb, it means it moves everywhere, or it cannot be restricted. Its movement cannot be restricted to one place. It can go anywhere, right? Air or wind moves everywhere. That's why it is sarvatragaha. It goes anywhere and everywhere. There are no boundaries for it. There might be two neighboring countries which may be very hostile to each other, but the wind cannot be stopped from moving from one country to the other freely, isn't it? But even this great Vayu, Mahan Vayuhu, that has no restrictions, it goes everywhere, it is everywhere all the time, but still is Akashastitaha. Nityam. Akashastitaha Nityam. It is always, eternally present only in Akasha or space. Yata Akashastito Nityam Vayuhu Sarvatrago Mahan. Just as this great Vayu that moves everywhere still continues to exist eternally in space. Tatha, so too, Sarvani Bhutani, all beings, Matsthani, rest in me or abide in me, Iti Upadharaya. Know this. Understand this. Just as the wind exists in space, all beings exist in me. The relationship between wind and space is the relationship between all beings and the Supreme Lord. The wind is sarvatraga. It goes everywhere. It is omnipresent. But it can go nowhere that is not in space. It can go anywhere, but that anywhere must be in space. In the whole of creation, all beings are contained in the Lord in that manner. We had a description of the various lokas, right up to the Brahma Loka or the Satya Loka. Imagine how vast this universe is. There are the seven lower lokas, Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Rasatala, Mahatala, and Patala. And then you have the seven higher lokas, starting from Earth, Bhu, Bhuvar, Suvar, Mahar, Janat, Tapo, and Satya Lokas. Through your sadhana, through your karmas, good and bad, you can go from this end of the lokas to that end. Just like how the wind goes from one end of the earth to the other. But yet, you will be moving or you will still be abiding in the Lord. Swami would often give a small chinakata about the rabbit that took a loan from Mother Earth. Swami would say, I don't know when Swami gave this analogy the first time, Swami would say, the loan amount was 4 paise. Right? That's what Swami would say, that this rabbit had taken a loan of 4 paisa or paise from Mother Earth. And it was not able to repay it. So the rabbit decided to run away from that place where it had taken the loan from Mother Earth. So the rabbit started running as fast as its feet could take it, and it went to a distant place. And just when it sighed in relief that it had come away, it had run away from Mother Earth, the earth speaks from beneath the rabbit's feet and it says, "Oh, you foolish little one, wherever you go, how can you ever run away from me? Because I am the one who is ever underneath you, right? All places are me." So this entire creation is contained in the Lord. Like the restless wind is contained in space. When Krishna says, "Sarvani bhutani matsthani," all bhutas are contained in me, it refers to space as well, right? Akasha is one of the panchabhutas. So bhutani means all beings, including the panchabhutas. So this entire universe with all beings and elements are contained in the Lord. Why is this also not a comprehensive example? For the same reason that we've been seeing. When we say all of us live in space, it means there is space within us as well, isn't it? There's a very interesting scientific fact that is often quoted. There's, of course, much debate whether this is a fact or just a wild approximation, but that doesn't matter. It kind of conveys a very important idea and makes sense. Most of us know the structure of an atom. You know, there is a nucleus which has the mass in it, which is the real matter. And then you have the cloud of electrons around it, pretty much very similar, but not exactly like the solar system, right? So you have the central mass and then the electron with the charge revolving around it. So according to one of the calculations, if we could remove the space in each atom, every human body on this planet, which is 7.4 billion odd or whatever it is, if you can remove the space in the atom in the body of every human being, and if you were to only collect the mass, that matter can be fit into the size of one sugar cube. It seems to be the day of the sugar, right? We're giving all examples of sugars and sugar cubes. But that's what it is. If you were to remove the space in the atom of every human body, and if you were to bring together all the matter, it would fit in to one sugar cube. This is the amount of space that exists within each one of us. So I am in space, but there is so much space within me too. But nevertheless, Krishna gives this example to set the perspective right. He is existent in us. We exist in him. But he is not existent only in us as the indweller. And our relationship with him is not merely that of contained and container, as we will further see in the shlokas to follow. But nevertheless, Krishna gives this example to kind of, if you look at this example as standalone, again, it will confuse. That is why it is important to look at it in the perspective of whatever Krishna has been saying so far. So though we refer to the Lord as Hridayavasi, the indweller, it doesn't mean he lives inside of us alone. We move and we live and we operate within him. So whether he is the indweller or we are the indwellers, that is again something that we will have to discuss. So we'll go to the next shloka. After having given this analogy, Krishna further discusses it in the next few shlokas. So we'll listen to the 7th shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss in detail.
Sarva bhutani kaunteya prakritim yanti mamikam kalpakshaye punastani kalpadau visrujamyaham.
O son of Kunti, all the beings go back at the end of a cycle to my prakriti. I project them forth again at the beginning of a cycle. So that is the 7th verse of the 9th chapter. The next few shlokas, including this one, are a recap of what Krishna had said in a few shlokas in the past few chapters. To just summarize for ourselves what was said in that past chapters, Krishna had said that everything that is seen is his prakriti, and that prakriti is eightfold. All matter is made of 5 elements, and then there is mano, buddhi, and ahankara, mind, intellect, and ego. The 5 bhutas and mano, buddhi, and ahankara. So this eightfold prakriti is what whatever we see is made up of. Then in the previous chapter, Krishna spoke of the day and night of Brahma and how all creation happens and is withdrawn at the end of the creation cycle. Krishna repeats that here. He says, Kaunteya, O son of Kunti, Sarva Bhutani, all beings, Yanti, go to Prakritim Mamikam, to my Prakriti, Kalpakshaye, at the end of the Kalpa. As we saw when we were discussing about the cycle of creation, one Kalpa is equal to 1000 Mahayugas, where each Mahayuga is made up of Krita, Treta, Dwapara and Kali, and the duration of a Kalpa is 43,20,000 years. So Krishna is saying, Sarva Bhutani Prakritim Yanti Mamikam Kalpakshaye. At the end of this Kalpa, of the said number of years, all beings return to my prakriti. This is quite interesting. Why is Krishna saying they return to my prakriti and not to me? We will discuss that in a bit. So after all beings have been withdrawn into his prakriti, what happens? He says, punaha, again, kalpa adav, at the beginning of the kalpa, tani visrajami aham, I send them forth, or I again project them. This is again something that we had discussed at the point in time when Krishna had said, bhutagramaha sa evayam bhutva bhutva praliyate. The multitude of beings are born again and again, and he specifically had said, sa evayam, that very lot, bhutagramaha, a word which will come again in the next shloka as well, the multitudes of bhutas, of beings, sa eva ayam, that very lot, bhutva bhutva praliyate, keep coming again and again and then dissolve, right? Their individual nature is maintained. That's what it means by what Krishna is saying here. Their individual nature is not dissolved. That's why Krishna says, avasha, they do not have a choice. They are not given that choice of whether they want to come back or not. As long as we've seen, there is current, there are karmic consequences, there is the ahankara, this coming back is something that the bhutas or those beings cannot do anything about. And that is also the reason that Krishna says that they return to my prakriti. This prakriti, as we have seen, is a result of the Lord's yoga maya. We had seen how the first effect of this yoga maya was that there appeared to be two where there was only one, or there is only one. What is that two? Para prakriti, the Lord's supreme nature, and apara prakriti. Actually, only apara prakriti appears to be created, and because apara prakriti is created, the para prakriti gets its identity as being para prakriti, right? We discussed all of this in the seventh chapter. So the Lord's limited manifestation, apara prakriti, is what we refer to as creation. And the whole spiritual exercise is to overcome this illusion. Till this is overcome, there will be no mixing of these two. There will be duality where there is only one. And when the illusion is overcome, still there is no mixing. The second just vanishes. There is no mixing here. The second loses its existence, right? So when Krishna says, all beings return to my prakriti, the delusion that they are individual entities is kept intact. Because if that delusion is removed, they don't return to prakriti, they return to my swarupa. They return to the truth that he really is. So Krishna is just stating how creation, sustenance and dissolution are processes that happen within the space that divinity is. Merging back into him, that will happen only with this jnana of the self. No passage of time can affect that. It is never going to happen that the Lord will say, chalo, so many million years have gone by, I'm tired of this particular jivatma, let him or let this jivatma. There's no him or her when you're talking about jivatma, right? So let this entity come back into me. No, that is never going to be the case. Millions and millions of years may pass, but unless and until this knowledge of the self is attained, the return will be only to prakriti, not to the Lord, right? And returning to prakriti means coming back into this cycle. But does any of this affect or change the Lord's nature? He's saying all of this is happening within me. Does it in any way change the nature of the Lord? Krishna categorically states that in the shlokas to follow. So we will go to the next shloka, we'll listen to it, and then we'll discuss what Krishna is saying there.
Prakritim svamavashtabhya visrujami punah punah bhutagramamimam kritsnam avasham prakritir vashat.
Keeping my own prakriti under control, I project forth again and again the whole of this multitude of beings which are powerless owing to the influence of prakriti. So that's the eighth verse of the ninth chapter. As I said, Krishna is reiterating a few points made earlier while explaining this relationship between the Lord and the creation. In this shloka, he reminds us of one important distinction between the creator and the created. Prakritim swam avashtabhya. Avashtabhya means to be in control of or to animate. Like the paintbrush of an artist or a musical instrument of a virtuoso. If I pick up an instrument like a violin, I have no control of the music that it produces, isn't it? So there will be only noise coming out of it. I still recall when we were in Vrindavan, we were trying to make up a band with the instruments that were available. And I was among that group and I was given the flute, right? And it's not the simple flute, the bamboo flute. It's what we refer to as a concert flute. It's made of metal, right? Till you get a hang of it, it's very difficult even to make noise with it, right? No sound will come out of it. And I recall one of the instructors who had come from the army was trying to teach us to play those instruments, coming and telling me, please try to take some sound of it, you know, make some sound of it, then we will try to make it into music. Because even though it's an instrument that is meant to produce music, if you do not have control over it, you are not going to be able to make even noise out of it. Forget music. Music comes later, right? So when you talk about an instrument, if you have control over it, then you can animate it. An expert, he or she has total control over the sound that the instrument produces, and hence they can animate the instrument to produce the melody that they choose, right? In the same way, Prakritim Swam Avashtabhya means having this Prakriti under my control, I animate it as I please, right? As I please, again, don't misunderstand it. There is no choosing, there is no pleasing, there is no wanting, there is no liking and disliking here, as we will see, as we have seen also in the past and as we will discuss today too. So he says, Prakritim Swam Avashtabhya, having this entire Prakriti under my control, Visrajami Punaha Punaha, I send forth again and again. Visrajami Punaha Punaha. Bhutagramam Imam Kritsnam. What do I send forth? Bhutagramam Imam Kritsnam. This entire multitude of beings, Avasham, which are helpless, Prakritehe Vashat, owing to the influence of Prakriti. As I was just telling you before I played the shloka, there is avashah, there is no choice for these beings. Why do they have no choice? Because they are under the control of Prakriti. So the distinction between the Lord and His creation is this: Prakritim Swam Avashtabhya, having control over the Prakriti, as he said. So the Lord is one who is the master of Prakriti. Avasham Prakritehe Vashat, being helpless under the influence of the same Prakriti, is the nature of the beings. And Krishna states, I animate this entire creation, and all this must give us a sense of deja vu, right? Because we've heard this many times in the previous chapters. Krishna spoke of all of this right in the beginning in the second chapter itself. But now, after having defined what is that Prakriti that rules us, then he spoke about the concepts of Prakriti as para and apara, and then having spoken about the cycle of creation, what is a kalpa, what happens at the end of a kalpa, at the beginning of a kalpa, Krishna now makes the same point. This, as I said while going through the second chapter, is the nature of this discourse. Krishna mentions all that needs to be told in the second chapter itself. Then slowly he is decoding this little by little. What is it to be under the influence of Prakriti? What is Prakriti? What is it? What does it mean to be the master of Prakriti? All of that is being slowly decoded in the chapters that follow. What all has Krishna said in this portion? If he were to just quickly summarize and go through, I am not dwelling in this creation and the beings. They all dwell in me. They abide in me. This entire creation dwells in me. And like the wind that does a lot, whatever happens is happening within me. If you look at the wind, one place it blows gently, bringing relief. At another place it causes havoc, becoming a tornado. One place it carries pollen grains and becomes the cause of life. In another place it carries viruses and bacteria and challenges life. But all this variety of events happen within that space. So too, everything that happens, good, bad, creation, destruction, all this happens within me. And all this came from me, will return to me, and will be projected again by me. So it doesn't really come back into me in the form of merging with the source. It merges back into my Prakriti, which means keeping intact their vasanas, their samskaras and their karmas. But when, you know, pretty much like what happens, as we've discussed, at the time of sleep, when I go into deep sleep, I'm actually giving up all the restrictions of my mind, all the karmas that are attached to this mind. I go into that absolute state of turiya, right? Or not turiya, sushupti. Into that state where you are in deep sleep, we have totally cut off from all of these restrictions that define me. But then when the day comes, I wake up into this limitedness. Why? Because my karmas have been kept intact through this process of deep sleep. In the same manner, at the time of the end of the kalpa, all karmas of these bhuta grama kritsnaha, all of these beings, multitude of beings, their account is kept safe. And when they are born again in the next kalpa, when they are projected again in the next kalpa, it has been given to them. The burden of their debt is returned to them, right? And finally he says, I use the prakriti to animate all of this creation. But influenced by the same prakriti, which is further made personalized by one's own vasanas and sanskaras, tendencies and culturing, each person acts. And whenever Krishna says, whatever happens in creation, I am the one doing it, we will always immediately have a certain doubt. And that Krishna addresses in the next shloka. So we will listen to that shloka, the ninth shloka of the ninth chapter. And then we will again raise that question and again try to understand what is the answer to that question.
Na cha mam tani karmani nibadhnanti dhananjaya udasina vadasinam asaktam teshu karmasu.
These acts do not bind me, O Arjuna. Sitting like one indifferent, unattached to those acts. So that is the ninth verse of the ninth chapter. As I said, when Krishna says that I am the one who is doing whatever is happening, or whatever is happening because of me, the question that arises is, so is God doing all the wrong that is happening in the world? Is God stealing through the thief, cheating through the cheat, murdering through the murderer? Is God responsible for the wrong things that are happening in my life? And is he the one who is doing the good actions too, right? If he's the one who is doing the bad, he's of course doing the good too, and it's vice versa. If you say that he's the one who is doing the good, then how can we say that he's not the one who is harming through the one who is bad? That is the question that immediately pops up in our mind, right? And this is not the first time. And we have addressed it whenever it has popped up, but it will keep popping up till wisdom dawns in this mind. There is no doership when Krishna says everything happens because of me. When we talk about karma yoga, when we talk about spiritually progressing, through this process of karma yoga, what is it that happens to an individual? I sublimate my doership. And that is how there is no consequences for the karmas that is performed, and there is no bondage. How can the Lord then have any doership at all? What is being referred to here as when Krishna says, I am the one who does, it is only sentience. The space is not responsible for the havoc caused by the wind. But there can be no devastating wind if there is no space for the wind to move, isn't it? Wind cannot move from one place to another in the absence of space, but at the same time, space cannot be blamed for the destruction that this wind causes, or even the pleasant happenings that the wind causes. And this has been dealt with in the seventh chapter, where Krishna said that everything is a projection of this prakriti, the good and the bad. But he can be recognized through the auspiciousness and the goodness that is present in all of this creation, right? And through these qualities that define various entities, that is the defining factor of these various entities, he can be recognized, right? When he said, I am the wetness in the water, I am the fury in the fire, you know, we came through all of those discussions. And at the same time, he said, I am the pleasant smell in the earth, and I am the goodness in the good people, and all of that also we saw. So when repeating the same points here, Krishna is quickly addressing that doubt that again would pop up in our mind when he says that he is the only doer. The question of God's doership does not exist at all. He says, నచమాం తాని కర్మాణి నిబధంతి ధనంజయ. ఓ ధనంజయ, ఓ కృష్ణ, సారీ ఓ ధనంజయ, ఓ అర్జున, తాని కర్మాణి, దీస్ కర్మాస్ నమాం నిబధంతి, డూ నాట్ బైండ్ మీ. బంధ మీన్స్ టు బైండ్, నిబంధ మీన్స్ టు బైండ్ ఆర్ టు పుట్ అండర్ బాండేజ్. నమాం నిబధంతి, దే డు నాట్ బైండ్ మీ. ఉదాసీనవత్ ఆసీనం, సిట్టింగ్ లైక్ వన్ హూ ఇస్ ఇన్డిఫరెంట్. అసక్తం తేషు, ఐఎమ్ అన్అటాచ్ టు దోస్ కర్మసు, దోస్ యాక్ట్స్. Krishna makes it very clear there is no involvement of doership in any of these actions. Udasina, that's a term that we will revisit many times in the Gita. Krishna will himself later speak of it as one of the qualities that the devotee or the sadhaka must cultivate. A state of being indifferent. One end of the spectrum is to like something, the other end of the spectrum is to not like something. One end is to be attached, one end is to be, repelled by something, right? To hate something. To be right in the middle, neither to like nor to dislike, neither to be attached nor to be, not to hate. That state is referred to as Udasina. To be right in the middle without any involvement in what is happening. So that's what Krishna says, Udasinavat. Asinam, I sit indifferently. When Krishna teaches us the secrets of yoga, when he teaches us karma yoga, we must remember that he is the embodiment of that knowledge that he is teaching. He is the Yogishvara. He is the teacher of yogi. He is the teacher of yoga and he is also Yogishvara. He is the perfect embodiment of that knowledge and hence the perfect example of that knowledge, right? That's why he says, I am udasinavat asinam. And asakta. Asakta is again a word that we've already come across a few times and he's going to mention it a few more times in the Gita too. To not be attached. Asakta is not to have any kind of binding to what is happening. I am unconnected, teshu, to these. To which? To these mentioned actions, the actions of creation, sustenance, and dissolution. He says, everything happens because of me, but I am in no way attached to it. I look at it in a state of witness. Udasinavat asinam. Asinam means to sit. Right? When you say sit, it means you're sitting back and you're not getting involved in anything. Being an indifferent witness to what is happening, but what is happening through him. But as Krishna said in the beginning of this chapter, and Swami stressed, this vision and understanding of God is not easy to grasp and easy to accept. This vision is only for the prepared mind. And as we saw last week, this is Krishna describing the whole journey of realizing God. You can worship him in any form, but then you have to graduate to the state of seeing him as the indweller of all forms eventually. But that is also not true because he is not the indweller, we are the indwellers in him. That is more accurate. But even this is not the absolute truth. The relationship is even more complicated than the container and the contained. So that whole journey is being described by Krishna here. And you cannot explain one without dismissing the previous. You make a statement and you have to go and refute that same statement. That's what we've seen in the past few shlokas. Krishna is saying, I am the indweller. And then he's saying, I am not the indweller. They are the indwellers. And then he's saying, I am the one who is operating through all of these. I am the one who is creating all of these. So the whole process is to explain the relationship between God and creation. and it is very complex. This various stages of understanding are grasped as one grows in maturity, in spiritual maturity. There are three or four terms that are used often to describe the relationship between two entities, right? Any two entities. And apparently these are terms that are mentioned in a few Upanishads where they try to explain the relationship between the Atma and the body. When we talk about the human apparatus as being the Atma covered by the various sheaths, koshas, right? The pancha koshas. So in trying to understand the relationship between the Atma and the pancha kosha, because it is one entity, right? Till you go into spirituality and till you start dissecting, you don't see that the Atma is separate from the body, right? We often think of it as one. That's why we use the word Atma, the self itself, to confuse with the body and the mind. So to understand the relationship between the Atma and the body and the mind and the other koshas, these terms are used. But these terms generally can be used to speak of any relationship between two entities. So what are these terms? The first two terms are Samavaya Sambandha and Samyoga Sambandha. The word Sambandha, as we all know, is relationship. Samavaya Sambandha is an inherent relationship between two entities. If you have two entities and they have a relationship which is born with their existence, then you refer to it as Samavaya Sambandha. Like the relationship between the limb and the body. An object and its quality, sugar and sweetness, since sugar is the theme of the day. A person who is performing the action and the action. These are entities that cannot be separated, right? There is an inbuilt connection between these two entities. Samavaya Sambandha. This is referred to as an inherent connection between the two. The next one is Samyoga Sambandha, which is an external connection that binds two entities. And the example that is often given in these scriptures is that between the drum and the drumsticks. They are two separate entities, but their utility brings them together, right? So it's an external connection between the two. If you want to give a modern context or modern example, the computer and the keyboard, something like that, right? When we talk about this relationship, there's definitely a samyoga, a need for them to be together, right? But the sambandha is external. It is not inbuilt. There is another type, which is not necessarily the third type, but when we are talking about the relationship between the Atma and the body, this becomes a very important and crucial relationship or crucial phrase. These are spoken mainly when, as I said, trying to understand the relationship between the Atma and the body, and we are trying to extend that to God and creation. And it is, it's not something that which is a overstretch of understanding. It is quite applicable to God and creation too. So the other type, the third type, is referred to as Tadatmya Sambandha, where there is a transference of a certain quality from one to the other. The first one is Samavaya Sambandha, where there is an inherent connection. Then there is Samyoga Sambandha. There is no inherent connection, but externally they come together. And the third one is Tadatmya Sambandha, where there is a transference of quality or nature from one to the other. The two classic examples that are given are milk and water, an iron ball and fire. When you mix milk and water, the milk mixes its qualities in water and the water mixes its qualities in milk. Same is the case when they talk about an iron ball, another very standard Vedantic example or analogy, right? The fire gives its qualities of heat and redness to the iron ball, so much so that you think that the iron ball is hot, right? When you touch the hot iron ball, you say the iron ball burnt me. Actually, it is the fire in the iron ball that burns, right? So there is a transference of quality that is referred to as tadatmya sambandha. Coming to this relationship between God and creation, if you look at it, it can be put in any of these categories as we have discussed. But to think that it is the relationship between the two, that there is a relationship between the two, is itself a sign of delusion. And that is what Krishna is establishing here through these many shlokas. There appears to be a samavaya sambandha. After all, it is all his prakriti, right? Creation being referred to as an anga or a limb of God is something that we have come across. Swami also often says that nature is a limb of God, society is a limb of nature, and the individual is a limb of society, and hence every individual is a limb of God. But this is not the absolute truth, only an idea or a concept that helps us to approach the ultimate truth. So when we talk about samavaya sambandha, it does not perfectly describe this relationship. So then, is the atma and the body completely separate? Do they come together for a certain purpose? So samyoga sambandha, does that define this relationship? That appears true because we keep hearing this concept of distinguishing atma from anatma, the discrimination between atma and anatma, isn't it? But that is also not absolute truth, because Krishna himself had said in the previous chapter, even the perishable nature, the ksharam, comes only from him. There is no other cause for it. So to say that there is only an external relationship is also not true. Then can we say there is tadatmya sambandha? An individual who is in deep contemplation of God, we have seen that even that individual's face starts glowing. Divine nature starts getting manifested in that person's actions and thoughts and words. And a materialistic person or a cruel person sometimes appears as though there is no conscience in that person. Even that conscience has been corrupted with that person's crudeness and rudeness. But as Krishna has been stating right from the beginning, this is also an illusion. The divine Atma remains pure all through. Even Duryodhana, who is there on the other side of the battlefield, however cruel he may be, the Atma in him is pure and divine. Right? And as Krishna said in just the verse that we covered, Udasinavat asinam asaktam teshu karmasu. The Atma sits there unaffected and untouched by all of these emotions and actions. So there can be no mixing of nature. The Atma is Chaitanya, it is Satchitananda. The physical body is Stula, it is Anityam. There can be no transference of the Nitya of the Atma to the body. Even if the body is that of the avatar, that body has to perish. So there is no tadatmya sambandham yar. So what is the relationship between the two? That is why Vedanta speaks about the fourth type of relationship, which is called adhyasa sambandha. The word adhyasa means superimposition. The other doesn't exist at all. This is what Maya does to the Lord. The Lord, who alone exists, is made to appear as many, but there was and is no many at all. And the classic Vedantic example for that, of course, is the snake and the rope. The snake never existed. It is superimposed over the rope. The rope alone is the truth. So the non-existent snake's attributes of being able to harm is now superimposed on the rope. There is no mixing of nature, but there is superimposition of nature. Without the rope lying there, there is no illusion at all. There is no emotion of fear, there is no fear of a snake. But the rope is not scaring me. though the rope is the cause for my fear. But just its presence creates this illusion of a snake being there. So the illusion of the snake and the emotions that follow all have been superimposed on this rope. But the rope has no doership of either scaring me or causing any emotions in me. And if you see, all different approaches to God meander through these different sambandhas till the point where it recognizes the real sambandha or relationship between God and creation as being adhyasa sambandha. He alone existed. My existence was itself an illusion. Or my idea that I am this body-mind complex, this jivatma, was merely a superimposition over this existence. Right? So that is the final truth towards which Vedanta is heading us to which bhakti leads us to which karma yoga leads us to. That is why it's nothing but a bundle of contradictions for the untrained mind. But for the trained mind, this should be seen as a journey. This should be seen till you reach the final truth, everything is false, right? So we are talking the language of truth, or we are trying to explain truth with the language of untruth. And there is bound to be so much of confusion in all of that. And that is the conundrum we are in the middle of and we are trying to make sense of. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. We've completed 9 verses of the 9th chapter. We'll take it forward from here the next week. So do join me again for the resumption of this pilgrimage. If you have any thoughts you would wish to share, feel free to write to us. You can write to listener at sssmediacenter.org, or you can write personally to me too if that suits you, Prem at ssmediacenter.org. If you have any thoughts, if you have any, if you did not agree with me, or as the other listener said that some things need to be clarified further, do let me know. And if time permits and if it is in line with what we are discussing, we'll definitely take it up in the subsequent episodes. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. I'll join you at 12 in the afternoon for the afternoon satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.